Hello, everybody. I'm Danny Boom Boom McCarthy.
Before you slip into unconsciousness, I'd like to have another kiss, another flashing chance at bliss, another kiss, another kiss.
Greetings and welcome back to the Story of Nowhere podcast, and a very happy Christmas and New Year's to you as well. I'm your host, Daniel McCarthy. Before we get into the meat of today's show, I want to get some business out of the way first. 2023 is going to be a big year for me, and I'm hoping for the Story of Nowhere project as well. As you may have heard at the very end of my recent bonus episode announcing the launch of the Nowhere Library, my wife Alice is pregnant. So our baby is going to be born in 2023. I'd say that alone makes it a pretty big year. But there's also the Nowhere Library bookstore itself. This, I hope, will begin to blossom into a small online business in 2023, so I can then put that money towards purchasing expensive old books and stuff for the podcast. And in the long, long, long term, hopefully, and maybe with the help of some other side hustles, not have to have an employer-employee, wage-earning, W-2 type of job. It's a big goal, and it's definitely far off, but ultimately, I want to be able to do research and print books and podcast full-time. When I'm not busy being a dad and home educating my children, of course. So now you know what I'm aiming at. And this Nowhere Library is the first big step in that direction. I decided a while back that if the Story of Nowhere project is going to bring in any money, it's going to actually make products. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'll happily take donations, if I can figure out how to set the damn thing up. Actually, I think you can make donations if you go to the podcast's page on anchor.fm. So yeah, donate. I'll take it and put it to good use. But I've shied away from the subscriber bonus content model, because frankly, I don't want anybody to think that because they've funded me, they have some sort of say over what I cover or don't cover on the show. I want to avoid this shareholder mentality that, unfortunately, seems pretty common in my generation. The idea that the paying customer becomes part owner of the thing being paid for. I'm not into that. I'm in charge of my show, and that's the way it is. I'd also like to avoid the possibility of some muckraker having some occasion to say, "Aha! The Story of Nowhere podcast is being funded by the Koch brothers," or anything like that. All right. So maybe I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself there. This is still, even after more than 2 years, a very small podcast. I'm a pretty shitty marketer. But damn it, I think the principle still holds. If I want to have my father-in-law on to debate the legitimacy of property, I'm going to do it. If I want to have Scott Hambrick on to criticize the Age of Enlightenment and modernity, I'm going to do it. And if I want to have Kevin Cole on to talk about January 6th, even though nobody else in the alternative media is even remotely interested, well, by gum, I'm going to do it. So, therefore, the show is free. Down the line, I may decide to sell packages or sets of recordings that you could, I guess, describe as bonus shows. For example, those old episodes of In Pursuit of Utopia with Brett Vanat. But these would be discrete digital products, not some ongoing subscriber type of thing. And on the subject of making money, just let it be known that I will never, ever do an ad read. I just can't. But a man still needs money. That's where we get back to the Nowhere Library. While I want to keep the podcast outside of the realm of money and payment and all that, just so I can preserve my feelings of creative freedom and intellectual integrity, I got no problem taking your money in exchange for a printed goddamn book. That doesn't really have anything to do with the show. It's just a bookstore. You don't have to like what I say to appreciate a nice copy of an old book you can't find anywhere else. Hell, I'd like for the bookstore to get to a point where people who don't even listen to the show or have never even heard of the show are buying from it. So that's how I want it. The show and the store are separate. Some of you may think I'm being unnecessarily convoluted with all this. After all, I'm using the show to point you to the bookstore, and I am the same guy behind both things, so buying from the bookstore is still kinda like funding the show, and they're both ultimately part of the Story of Nowhere project, right? Well, it's true that it's all the same project, but I think the important difference is that when you buy a book, you're actually paying for a tangible product. It's a simple one-to-one transaction, money for book. But when you subscribe or whatever to a podcast, what are you paying for then? You're paying for content that you like, presumably with the expectation that this content will continue to come. In short, you're buying potential influence over the podcaster. If you stop liking the content, you can pull your money out. I, as the podcaster, know this. If I, the podcaster, build up a certain kind of audience who pays me, might I be inclined to produce content for them? Might I be incentivized to cover certain things as opposed to other things, or to cover things in a certain way, all to please these paying customers? Might I hesitate to change my mind, or admit that I've changed my mind on a big issue or something, if I fear that doing so will cost me a huge chunk of my audience's money? And on and on and on. I'm not saying that podcasters who follow the subscription model are guilty of any of these things. I'm just pointing the incentive problem out and telling you that I've decided to avoid the temptation entirely. So, I sell books. And in that endeavor, I will gladly take requests for a fee. In short, I'm keeping my economic activity separate from my creative, intellectual activity. Buying a book doesn't buy you any influence over the show, just like listening to the show doesn't get you a free book. So, having said all that, the Nowhere Library will go nowhere without you guys, the listeners. So head over to storyofnowhere.com/library and browse the short catalog of books I have available there, and consider buying one or a few. And remember that if you think of a book that belongs in the Nowhere Library and is in the public domain, send an email to nowherelibrary@mail.com and we'll work something out. By the way, public domain now includes most works published in or before 1927. And of course, while you're at storyofnowhere.com, pick up a paperback copy of The Story of Nowhere, written by yours truly. You can also email me if you're interested in grabbing a copy of my father-in-law's book, No Bottom Road, discussed in the last episode of the podcast. Finally, subscribe to the podcast and share it far and wide. Give a copy of the book to a friend. It's really short. And share the Nowhere Library with anyone you know who appreciates the value of preserving physical copies of historical materials, and let them know that, by making requests, they can participate in this very important project. All right, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, let's get on into it. Today's episode is another one I've taken from a meeting I conducted in Brett Vanat's University. The last show like this was episode 28. This time, I asked the participants to listen to a roughly 30-minute interview beforehand between film historian and CBC radio broadcaster Tony Thomas and the famous frontman of The Doors, the Lizard King himself, Jim Morrison. I wanted to discuss this interview, first and foremost, because I found it interesting. It was conducted in May of 1970, 52, 53 years ago, and just barely over 1 year before Jim would be found dead in Paris. In the interview, they reflect on the phenomenon that was the 1960s counterculture, and then attempt to project into the future where it might lead. And here we are, half a century later, able to look back, and to look around, and see how well their projections match our reality. Like I said, interesting. But also, the subjects they discuss are, I think, highly relevant to us today, and at times this can be almost uncanny in the interview. Without giving too much away, two of the major things discussed in the interview are gender roles, specifically the role of masculinity in a feminized world, and the rising importance of what Morrison calls connectors, people who are able to mobilize huge groups of people across the country. Naturally, my companions and I are able to get quite a bit out of this interview, so we get into things like the impact of technology and media on culture, whether or not the so-called sexual revolution was all good, war and human nature, and of course, whether the counterculture was entirely organic and innocent, or if it was, at least to some degree, a government op. Great stuff! But hold on! There's another reason I wanted to talk about this interview. For a while now, I've been loosely interested in the generational theory propounded by William Strauss and Neil Howe. To make a very long story short, back in the 90s, these two guys argued that there are four types of generations which follow sequentially, one from the other, in a predictable fashion, in a cyclically repeating pattern. I'd been aware of this theory for a while, as I say, but it was only after this discussion that I actually read one of Strauss and Howe's books on the subject. Even still, their theory was on my mind when I decided to host a conversation on this interview. Basically, Strauss and Howe say that each of the four types of generation has its own distinct traits. In their first book, Generations, the one that I just read, published in 1991, they name these four types. However, in their second book, The Fourth Turning, which I have not read, published in 1997, they update these names. I will very briefly summarize the attributes of these four distinct generational types using Strauss and Howe's updated names. First up, the prophets. These are people who are born after a crisis. They grow up indulged during a post-crisis high. Because the external world is largely taken care of for them, they tend to take it for granted, rebel against the status quo, and turn inward. All of America's great awakenings, including the 60s counterculture, occurred when a prophet generation was coming of age. Self-righteous, and some might say spoiled, they lack the political scruples of previous generations who had lived through and experienced the crisis. As a result, they play a part in fomenting the next crisis as elders. However, Strauss and Howe say, they typically age gracefully into the role of aged sage and lead the younger generation of heroes to victory. The current living prophet generation is the boomers. Typically, people place the boomer birth years between 1946 and 1964, But, for reasons I won't get into here, Strauss and Howe argue that boomers were actually born from 1943 to 1960. Examples of famous boomers would be Steve Jobs, Donald Trump, and, if we go with Strauss and Howe's 1943 start date, Jim Morrison. The prophet generation before the boomers was the missionary generation, born from 1860 to 1882, and included the likes of Jane Addams and FDR. Next up, the nomads. These guys are children during the prophet-inspired awakening. Growing up fairly neglected while their older parents are off trying to find themselves, nomads wind up practical, self-sufficient, non-idealistic, and cynical. But, as a result, they tend to prize liberty and responsibility over duty and free love. In midlife, when it hits, they act as the gruff, no-nonsense managers of the next crisis. Today's living nomad type is Gen X, born from 1961 to 1981. Examples include Elon Musk and Tupac. The nomad type before that was the Lost Generation, born from 1883 to 1900. This generation included people like Dwight Eisenhower and Al Capone. Third on the list, the hero type. These kids grow up after the awakening has reached its peak, and once the national hangover begins. As a result, parents actually pay attention to these kids, and protect them and encourage them in ways that the parents of nomads never did. Around the time of their coming of age, the next crisis begins, and they prove to be the heroes indeed. A decisive victory under their belt, in midlife, this confident but conformist generation establishes the new status quo, that when these heroes are in elderhood, the next generation of prophets will rebel against. Today's heroes, God save us, are the millennials, born between 1982 and 2004. Famous millennials are Mark Zuckerberg and that insipid British royal couple some people seem to care about from time to time. An example of a not-famous millennial is me. The hero type that came before the millennials was the GI generation, the so-called greatest generation, born between 1901 and 1924. This generation included the likes of Ronald Reagan and JFK. Fourth and finally, the artist type. Artists grow up during a crisis, so they tend to be overprotected. They grow up sheltered and sensitive, and eventually find themselves caught between their hero elders and their prophet juniors in another post-crisis culture war. They add color to the gray institutions the elder heroes wrought, and also pave the way, but perhaps less forcefully, for the culture clash that the young prophets will soon head up. Those who have been born since 2005, right up to now, and probably up until 2025 or thereabouts, are Gen Z, the Zoomers, and they fall into this artist archetype. Examples of Zoomers include Greta Thunberg and probably a good chunk of Instagram. The previous artist type was, or is, the Silent Generation, born between 1925 and 1942. Examples include Joe Biden and George Carlin. Okay. I know that was quite a bit of information all at once there, and I understand that it might all sound kind of fishy to you. That's fine. I get it. I don't want to get into the nitty-gritty of Strauss and Howe's model here. This is already gearing up to be a pretty long episode. I just want you to have a general awareness that there is this generational theory, which basically says that intergenerational relations are not progressive or linear, so much as they're cyclical. Cocky heroes establish a rigid, secure status quo following a crisis. Spoiled prophets tear it down and then inspire the next generation of heroes to overcome a new crisis. These cocky heroes establish a new status quo, new spoiled prophets tear it down. All the while, nomads and artists are caught in between. You get the picture. Sure, the theory has more to it than that, but that's basically it. Jim Morrison is a boomer hero. I mean, he's a heroic figure to the boomers, which he also is, at least according to Strauss and Howe. Anyway, he was behind some of the most important boomer art. He exemplified the sort of mystically self-righteous, burn this motherfucker to the ground mentality that boomers really appreciated back in their youth. In fact, Jim even exemplified the generation war, maybe better than anybody. His hero-type GI generation dad, back in 1964, was actually in charge of a naval carrier division and on-site during the super-sketchy, super-suspect Gulf of Tonkin event. In other words, Jim Morrison's dad was actually a part of the beginning of the official war in Vietnam. And of course, the war went on to be a major issue among Jim's boomer countercultural contemporaries. So anyway, in the interview my friends and I discuss here, Jim presents what I would describe as a characteristically idealistic boomer outlook on his own time and on the future. But in the interview, this worldview is presented as if it is, for lack of a better term, progressive, that it arose as a necessary challenge to the old, rigid system, but will continue on indefinitely, perhaps getting more and more extreme, but apparently always still accepting the foundational boomer profit ideals. Until, well, until what? Utopia? That seems to be the implication. What Jim's characteristically boomer analysis lacks, I think, is this idea that generations are not progressive or linear, but are instead cyclical. To be fair, Jim does actually mention cyclical history in the interview, but not quite in this context. So what he misses, I think, is the possibility that the boomer ideals he championed may one day lead, not to utopia, but to a societal unraveling, which then leads new, younger generations, like Gen X, Millennials, and Gen Z, to repudiating boomer idealism and reverting back to more traditional, conservative values. Of course, this implies that eventually, roughly 20 years from now, a new profit generation will emerge to challenge these new, old values. But that's getting ahead of ourselves. What you're going to hear today is a group of Millennials. At least, I think all of us on the call are Millennials. One person on the call may be Gen X, but I know for sure that at least three of the four of us are Millennials, all discussing Boomer Jim Morrison's outlook on America and its future 50 years ago. I should also note that even though we are mostly, if not all, Millennials in this discussion, I'm the youngest of the bunch, and am now, and at the time of this conversation, just 1 year older than Jim was at the time of the interview. And yet, you may notice some fundamental differences in our mindsets. So, yes, this is a critical conversation. We do challenge Jim's outlook, and therefore challenge the old boomer idealism of the late 60s and early 70s. But even so, I am a fan of Jim and the Doors, and though we may disagree, I do still like Jim, though obviously I never knew the guy. And I appreciate, if nothing else, his ability to thoughtfully discuss these big ideas that he does in the interview. I've also got the advantage of 50 years of hindsight, plus the work of Strauss and Howe, which he didn't live to see. So I can't hold those limitations against him. In sum, what you get today is an interesting conversation about culture and society, as three, maybe four, Millennials dissect the worldview of boomer hero Jim Morrison. But before I play our modern conversation for you, I'm first going to play you the entire 1970 interview between Jim Morrison and Tony Thomas. It's only about 27 minutes long, and I really think you need to hear it yourself in order to really appreciate our discussion of it. So, before I poison the well any more than I may already have, here is the interview, and then the discussion. Thanks for listening. Enjoy.
Is everybody in? Is everybody in? Is everybody in? The ceremony is about to begin.
Jim, What do young people worship today? What do they believe? What do they hang on to? What do they hope for?
I can't speak for young people, but probably a guess would be the same things they've always celebrated, just kind of a joy of existence, self-discovery, freedom, that kind of thing.
Well, there's always been a generation gap in every age, but the gap now seems to be much more of a definite cleavage. The young people today seem to feel and think differently. Mm-hmm. What do you think has brought this about?
Well, possibly it could have a strictly sociological basis. It could be the so-called generation gap could be a result of just larger numbers of young people. I think it happened after World War II. I think it's something like over half the population in the United States now is under 18 years of age, something like that.
Politically and philosophically, the young people now seem to feel very definite ideas about the establishment, mm-hmm. old systems of governing people, and moral attitudes.
Yeah. When I was in high school and college, the kind of protest that's going on now is totally unheard of. At that time, to be a teenager, to be young, was it was really nothing. It was kind of a limbo state. And I think it's amazing, just in the last 5 years, what's happened is young people have become increasingly aware of the power and the influence that they have as a group. It's really amazing.
Does it surprise you that there is so much revolt on the campuses of this country against Washington and its policies?
It really surprises me because, as I said before, when I was growing up and when I was in school, it was that was totally unheard of. You know, students really had no power. But if you look back in history, it seems to bear out the fact that every revolution has started with students and spread to workers. And I'm not predicting there's going to be a drastic turnover in this country, but all the indications are there.
Life does seem to become more and more involved and complex. You know, we're becoming computerized and dehumanized in that process. That bugs me. I wonder how it bothers you and your generation.
There does seem to be a trend toward a return to a kind of primitive outlook on life, a more tribal attitude, and I think it's a natural reaction to industrialization, but unfortunately, I think it's kind of naive because I think the future is going to become increasingly mechanized, computerized, as you call it, and I don't think there's any turning back. It's just figuring out a way to survive and thrive in that kind of society. I don't think there's any chance of going back. And look at it this way too: the hippie lifestyle is really a middle class phenomena, and it could not exist in any other society except ours, where there's such an incredible surfeit of goods, products, and leisure time. I think that's the reason for it, because the generations immediately preceding ours had world wars and depressions to contend with, and for the last 10 or 15 years in this country, it's there's time enough and there's money enough to live a kind of a flagrant, outrageous lifestyle, which was impossible before.
Jim, there's a line in your book of poems which reads, "The cleavage of men into actor and spectators is the central fact of our time." Well, I think that's undeniable, but I wonder, hasn't it always been that way with society?
I suppose it has, but it's with mass media and all today, it becomes more immediately apparent. I think what I was concerned with in that book was the fact that most people feel completely void and helpless in controlling their own destinies or controlling the destiny of human life. And I think it's sad. More people should be involved rather than designating all these powers to a few individuals. I think the average person, whatever that is, should be a part of it somehow. And I think everyone feels that events are just going on without their knowledge or control. I think it's one of the tragedies of our time. I suppose it has always been that way, but now it's just become so obvious, you know. Decisions are made for you in which you have no part of at all. I just lament the fact that so many people are content with living a very quiet, well-mannered, orderly life when so many obvious injustices, I guess, are going on, and they just seem to ignore it somehow, or not care at all, just let it happen without ever becoming involved. I think that's sad.
Jim, relevant to your theory that people should get more involved in life and thus enjoy it more, you have written a line of poetry which reads, "The spectator is a dying animal." Now, isn't that a bit of a contradiction to what you've said previously?
No, it's concerned with that same split between the actor and the audience. To me, there's something incredibly sad about a bunch of human beings sitting down watching something take place. And just when you think about it, I love movies as much as anyone else, but the spectacle of millions and millions of people sitting in movie theaters and in front of television sets every night watching a second or third hand reproduction of reality going on when the real world is right there in their living room or right outside in the street or down the block somewhere. I think it's a tool to somnambulize or hypnotize people into a kind of waking sleep. But I think the major influence in the next decade or so is going to be the people, I don't know what you'd call them except maybe the connectors, the people who are able to assemble masses, huge masses of people into one spot, as we've witnessed in pop festivals in the last 2 or 3 years. The kind of people that can assemble huge crowds in one spot, I think will be the major influences on mass culture in the next decade. I think the rock music enthusiasts have created probably some of the most exciting music and theatrical events on the planet. I think they're fantastic.
Well, part of Generation Gap is the difference in what people like in terms of music. Now, the rock and hard rock do seem to go hand in hand with the younger crowd, and some of us who are a little older are confused and puzzled by that, because we can't quite cotton on to this sound. Can you understand that?
You know, adolescence and early youth, the fires are burning fastest, right? And your energy level is probably at its highest, and so it demands a kind of raucous, screaming type music. And I'm 26 now, and I'm getting more interested in jazz, to tell you the truth. I can't even listen to the radio anymore. You know, I like old blues cats and early rock and roll and some other things, but frankly, I find most of it really boring.
This is something that distresses me a little bit. It seems that the young people like all the same kind of thing. Now, I want more out of the young people than just that.
Yeah, well, they're being programmed by their radios. They only play the major radio stations, rock stations, only play 30 songs over and over and over, 24 hours a day. And it's been proven that what you hear the most is what you like the most. So there's really no choice involved. Someone is programming it.
So we are the victims of media.
Uh-huh. What everyone should say is the medium is the message, and the message is me. I mean, that's the answer, is for everyone to... You're asking for an answer. The answer is for everyone to stand up and say, I'm me, and be fully aware of that fact and let everyone else know it.
Yeah.
That you are yourself, and express it.
Jim, we're talking about communication, watching the box, etc., etc., being victimized by the media. Well, there's a sort of a voyeurism in the air today, and you have a line which says, more or less, we're all afflicted with the psychology of the voyeur. That, to me, seems to be tragic.
What it is somehow life gets restricted to what can be seen rather than what can be touched or experienced physically. I don't know whether it's a natural, civilized human fear of involvement, because, you know, touch can lead to a lot of physical involvement leads to all the, you know, the real basic existential moments in life. Sex, death, love, you know. They have really nothing to do with seeing, experiencing secondhand. You have to get in there and actually do it. And there just seems to be some kind of natural civilized inclination to avoid contact with the nitty-gritty of life.
Well, we can't talk about life today and not talk about sex. Now, this confuses me, because we have a so-called new morality, and I keep looking at it and trying to figure out what it is.
There is, though, you know. I can remember when I was in high school, and even college, which wasn't that many years ago, and sex was still in the Victorian age. It was... very hush-hush. You know, if you suspected a girl of, you know, one of the ones that was doing it, you know, it was like kind of a, you know, locker room conversations and all that. And I think that this new group of kids that have come along have You know, I mean, sex will always be a mystery and it will always have its hang-ups and strange things about it. But they're much more free. I mean, it's just, you know, accepted as a fact of life and not, you know, not something to be snickered about in private, you know, behind closed doors and all that. I think there definitely is a new style. I think it was a necessary reaction to some kind of weird repression. I don't know how it started, you know, or when, but it was totally unnatural. And I think that is one aspect of the new thing that is happening that is completely beneficial. The repression of sexual energy has always been the grandest tool of a totalitarian system. If everyone was free in their sexual activity, how many people would show up for work? That's the basic problem. Whether progress, the progress of civilization, the evolution of civilized culture is really worth it. And, you know, there have been some amazing accomplishments, beautiful accomplishments, but the question is it worth it? Is it worth the repression? And that's something everyone has to answer every second of their life.
When you talk to young people, you go through them, you see them all the time. Do you get the impression from them that they think that life is worthwhile, that it's worth living, that it's a ball?
I'll tell you the damn truth. I don't know that many young people. I really don't. I mean, I hang out with my contemporaries, and I really don't have that much contact with young people.
Well, you're 26. You're young to me.
Yeah. But I'm over the hill.
Do you wish you were 10 years younger?
Nah. I think generations now happen every year or maybe every month, you know, rather than it used to be, I don't know, 10 years or something like that. But I think there's a new, things are changing so fast, there's a new generation every year at least.
Jim, I don't think there's any topic that has sort of defined the young revolution more than the topic of war. I don't know anyone who's really in favor of war, but today we seem to have an entire young generation absolutely opposed to the very idea of it.
And probably because they're the ones that always fight the wars. They're the human fodder for the war machine. And there just seems to be no way around it. There's just no cause. I'm sure the whole basis of the war going on now is economic, and I think young people just got tired of being grist for the mill. But you know, it's a funny thing. From the comfortable position of your TV set in your living room, war is a very, no matter how horrible, well, it's the horror, it makes it very glamorous, you know. It's a great drama, life and death right there, a struggle. And we're all infected from youth, you know, with little kids running around playing war and playing cowboys and Indians or whatever. You know, it's just ingrained in you from the beginning that there's something heroic, you know, proving yourself in battle and all that kind of thing.
The very hero concept seems to have changed in these past few years, doesn't it?
No heroes have come out of this present conflict. It's very strange. There's no support for it, hardly even in the press, you know.
And the young people no longer worship warriors the way we used to.
Right. Somewhere in you, you have to entertain these utopian concepts that life could work without all that struggle. Probably not, but I mean, something in us always entertains the fantasy that the world could run without war.
Well, society has always needed, apparently, to worship heroes. Now, where are young people today looking for heroes? What type heroes?
I think the new heroes will probably be political activists. In the 20s, it was sports figures, 30s and 40s, it was movie stars and World War II aces and all that kind of thing. And then the music figures became the heroes. I think the next heroes will probably be a more intellectual sort, political activists and perhaps scientists and computer experts, people like that. People that have an understanding, an intellectual awareness, and a knowledge of how things run, how modern society runs, and they'll probably be the new heroes. I think each generation supersedes the last one in intelligence and awareness, and I think there's been a giant step recently. The young people that I've seen in my travels around, while they're very young and naive in a lot of ways, I think they have an incredible intelligence and awareness of events that far surpasses the people I grew up with. I think, I like to be pessimistic, but I think from what I've seen, they're far better equipped to handle what's coming. Well, they'll have to be.
Jim, in talking about life today, we have the business of the sexual relationship, the relationship between men and women, and we all wonder how much it has changed, the role of the man in modern life and the woman in modern life. We even have a horrible thing called unisex, which terrifies me. Do you think there's much of a difference in the style of life affecting the man-woman relationship today?
Well, when you look at history, it seems to be cyclical. There have been many periods in history where women were the major controlling influence in life. Matriarchal societies and all that kind of thing. I think women are becoming increasingly important. I mean, it's a ridiculous thing to try and talk about, in such simple terms, but I think the influence of women is becoming more and more felt. I'm not sure I can expand on that, but I think you know what I mean. I think, the unisex trip is really a cop-out. What's happening is life is becoming more and more feminized.
Really?
I think so.
That the male is now less masculine because he has no need to be very masculine.
Yeah, that's true. And, there's no frontier to conquer and hunting and fishing and all that. It's not a basic survival thing. And I think life is becoming increasingly feminized.
And softer for man.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that's good?
Sure.
Why?
Well, I think women have it all over men, really. I really think they had the right idea.
Which is what?
Well, less inclination toward intellectualizing things and the need for formalizing and idealizing life and just simply accepting it and living it.
We tend to think of women as being starry-eyed and romantic, but if you think about it, most of the romanticizers and the idealists are men.
Well, very true.
Do you think that will change?
Yeah, I think it's cyclical, but I think in a highly complex and industrialized system which we're engaged in, machines take the place of an earnest day-to-day tackling of survival. And when that disappears, then you get increased feminization.
Well, you're a student of the cinema. You've studied cinema at UCLA. And one of the things that you've written about the cinema is this. It is wrong to assume, as some have done, that cinema belongs to women. Cinema is created by men for the consolation of men. Would you enlarge upon that?
Well, who makes all the films? Who runs the projection booth? You know, it's a... It's that masculine desire to dominate life rather than just accepting it and flowing with it. And I think that is responsible for the creation of films and a lot of other things.
Well, men are dominant in the arts, aren't they, as writers, composers, actors, almost everything.
Yeah, there are very few female artists.
You think they're wise to keep out of it?
Well, yeah, I do. Although, you know, it's a contradiction because I'm totally hung up in the art game, but I think, women have less need to reestablish a connection with life because they are life.
We've had these same conversations that, like, Jim Morrison was talking about, right? You know, like, this is, there, a lot of them are in the national forefront. Or you could go all the way back to, you know, Aristotle, and they were having similar ones. Or, and it's just like, we're like, I don't know, we're doomed to, like, always have the, you know, four turnings, you know, first, second, and third. And, you know, it's just like a structure of human, you know, a feature of human existence. It's just, where do you fit within that, you know, that time frame? Probably the most prescient thing I think he talked about was the whole idea of the events and how, like, you know, putting big, like, events together. You know, if you think, I mean, I don't know, was that pre-Woodstock?
Yeah, this is after Woodstock.
So that would have been, like, so he saw that Woodstock as, like, you think of, like, you know, Lollapaloozas or, you know, Burning Man's or, you know, any type of these type of, like, big giant events or, you know, that people get together for. I mean, there's so many of them. It's disgusting. Like, there's always, oh, hey, look at, it's $150 for this 3-day event. Come bring your tent and camp out, and we'll have like 200 bands that you've never heard of. And there's always that person that actually does know the bands that just talks, oh, this band is awesome. And you're like, how do you know? How do you have time to, like, learn all these bands? So,
especially then,
right? The ability to organize something on that scale was, I suppose, pretty new. It's not that people weren't able to organize things before that. It's just that there couldn't be really a countercultural organization to that level because, you know, how are you going to print the flyers? How are you going to get notices in all the various newspapers of the country? You know, to be able to organize something that maybe wasn't quite sanctioned by the common culture, the status quo culture. I don't know, 60s, maybe it wasn't new technology per se, but the changing attitudes, I guess, of people forced them in their own way to leverage what technology they had in order to accumulate these massive festivals of people doing things that ostensibly were not acceptable to the older generations. I mean, you know, we all hear stories about Woodstock is the greatest example, but people are doing drugs and banging, you know, like, you're not supposed to be doing either of those things in the proper culture, but there they were. And people came from all over the country to do that. And it's hard to imagine something that big happening really before the 60s.
I don't know. I think that's kind of like a bias, like, because there was a thing that that Morrison, like I said, I don't know his politics. I don't know if he was a commie or anything like that, but he seemed like super aware that, like, hippies could only exist after like this huge wealth was created. He had a line in there about that.
Yeah.
So that was just kind of one of those things that's just very, very interesting, you know, on that end, that it was just kind of like, well, you know, basically, you know, he still had like the Marxist idea where like, it basically starts with the bourgeoisie, right? The very bougie, the rich kids, you know, are the ones that start the revolutions because they're got, you know, they're like, hey, dad, right? And then it like goes down to the worker, but it's just very much of a, I don't know, like it is weird. Like there's a connectivity that started to happen with technology that I would say it probably predates, you know, even the 60s. Because if you look at like the 20s and even you go back to like, you know, the pamphlet era of the revolution, right? You know, you had, you know, Ben Franklin, that, you know, you had printing presses everywhere and they would print these pamphlets and then just distribute them out everywhere. In the 1850s and 60s, or mostly the 50s, basically, you think about how partisan the media is now. It was like way worse then. Like, I mean, I've read a couple of the excerpts of like a lot of the, you know, the press, and I mean, they were just so huge partisan hacks, and they were spread everywhere. I don't know if it was a bigger deal than it was, or was it just like, hey, this is the only thing I can actually, you know, I can read this pamphlet after I'm done, you know, working all day, right? But like, you know, so, you know, these type of things, like when it comes to, you know, how many people show up, for events and stuff, I don't know. I'm positive there has to be some like large events that had like, you know, thousands of people that showed up to something in just one area, you know, that predates, you know, Woodstock or the 60s.
Abraham Lincoln's dead body, maybe.
Well, yeah, maybe. Maybe like I don't know who showed up to JFK's funeral. Like that was before Woodstock. It was in the 60s. But I get what you're saying. And I think that you're right. Fundamentally, I think that, yeah, I'm sure there were gigantic gatherings before the 60s, probably before the 20th century. But my guess would be that by and large, those gatherings would have been more regional rather than national. And the reasoning behind that is simply, so I think probably the most important technology that existed at the time of the 1960s that would facilitate the national gatherings that Jim was talking about isn't so much the communication stuff like newspapers or telephones or whatever. I think it's the automobile and the accessibility of the automobile, because, you know, Woodstock was what, 3 days long in New York? Well,
yeah.
If you live in California, how are you going to get there? You know, are you going to go by rail? Are just trains and train loads of kids going to go? Maybe. How long of a journey is that going to be? How much trouble are they going to encounter? I don't know. And I'm not saying it's impossible for that to have happened in a pre-automobile world. It just seems to make it so much easier.
Yeah, That's fair.
So that's like, it's not impossible. And certainly there would be mass meetings regionally. But I mean, we're talking about the entire United States, and also, you know, the sort of hippie culture that culminated in Woodstock. Before Woodstock, where was the center of the hippie culture? It was in California, right? Like Haight-Ashbury and all that stuff. So yeah, we're talking about a movement that it's like home base was on the Pacific coast, but its ultimate event was pretty close to being on the East Coast. And all these people were just able to go back and forth. And that really makes it a national movement rather than a regional thing, which if you go back into the 1800s, there were a bunch of weird kind of pre-hippie movements across the United States. But they, by and large, remained regional, because how are you going to get there, you know?
Well, I think that has more to do with the fact that the United States wasn't really a nation, you know, in the 19th century, and really argument until after World War II, I think it was, you know, the United States itself was pretty regional.
Well, right.
So I don't think that's a technological thing as much as more of it is a government thing, right? So, you know, that phenomenon. I mean, in many ways, the United States is still sectional, much more than people, you know, I think more than people realize. It's like, you know, people that care a lot about trains and subways, they live in big cities. But if you don't live in a big city, then you're just like, we have a regional bus that just is always empty. And, you know, we pay like $5 million a year for, you know, in taxes. And it's just like, why are we doing this? Nobody rides that bus, right? There's like eight grandmas that use it. And they're like, well, why don't we just give them all Ubers? I mean, like, you know. But I think with it being national, I think you look at, like, because really, basically, I think the country became a nation after, you know, World War II, because that was where you had the mixing of all the different areas, right? You know, you had, you know, people in Alabama serving with people in New York. Because even, you know, even in, you know, World War One, it was still more like regional companies, right? You know, I mean, Alvin York was with his Tennessee or Kentucky group. I think it was Tennessee, right? When he went to, when he went over to Europe. Whereas with World War II, they were all mixed, right? You know, they all, you know, boot camp, you know, they didn't go as a group. Mm-hmm. And then you figure, and then what's, you know, 20 years after that, right? Maybe these were the, you know, the kids that remember their dad going to be in or going to World War One. And then now, you know, 20, 25 years later, you know, they're the ones going to Woodstock because they, you know, they probably were young enough where they didn't remember the country as more of a regional, but then they come back and like their dad's best friend lives across the country, you know, his war buddy. And then he talks about, you know, I don't know, Europe or whatever. And then, you know, it's kind of just like, and then now he had another comment that kind of got me think about what's with the TV is this idea about everybody going to the movies. And it's like how it's not real. It's like, and so I think a lot about that, about like the fakeness of everything. But I think the country itself is like, these are, so Woodstock and this thing, these are the children, the first generation of a country. Before that, United States wasn't a country, right? It was states. So that may have something to do with it too, you know, because there is a national zeitgeist. There is a national consciousness that exists that never really existed before.
The things that like stuck in my mind was also that he was talking about, like the hippie movement wouldn't have been possible if there was time enough and there was money enough, you know, for that to even take place. And we're probably at that point now, maybe the peak, right? It's in their hands. They're not, I guess, is worried about making ends meet or securing their food or any of that. So they're like, I'm going to spend all day on fucking the internet, which isn't real, screeching about how my life is so fucked up because of all these other people, you know, this external stuff. So that was something that stood out to me. And then also I liked everything he said about, which felt like individualism type stuff. And I think collectivism is just another form of dehumanizing others, you know. And I think I felt that way too a little bit about like watching TV, you know, or movies. And I think that's maybe one of the things that makes me like live theater so much better, you know, because you're like you're there. It's real, it's live. It's happening right now. That actor fucks up, you're going to see it, you know, or not that I'm like, I go to plays to watch people bomb or something like that, but it's just, it's more real. And I liked what he was talking about, that part of like touch, you know, which that feels very relevant, especially in the last 2 years of how it's been like, don't get together, you know. It's like, well, I'm better off just behind my computer screen than getting together with somebody. And also him talking about self-discovery and stuff like that.
No, it's interesting because, you know, there was a pandemic going on during Woodstock. So there was a pandemic in the late 50s and in the late 60s.
Seriously?
Yeah, from China too, both of them. Yeah. It was like the Hong Kong flu.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah, yeah.
What was the name of the flu?
I think it was the Hong Kong flu. Like, I just remember Jeffrey Tucker wrote an article about it. It was like, because I was really worried about the pandemic. And then he explained, he did the research on this even before, you know, COVID. So he kind of had this ready to go. He was noticing this like in the mid aughts. Yeah. So like I said, I think it was the Hong Kong flu. I can't remember the, yeah, it was an influenza flu, 1968. You know, you had, there was one in the late 50s. And, I mean, these weren't as bad as the Spanish flu, obviously.
Right.
And I think like 100,000 or 300,000 Americans died from that flu. And it was going on during Woodstock. So there's a pandemic going on. And the, you know, the same, you know, grandmas that are like, hey, you can't hang out together during a pandemic. They were actually hanging out together during a pandemic, right?
Right. Yeah. How boomers have changed.
Yeah. Yeah.
So were people actually being like dissuaded, like actively, like, hey, don't do that, don't get together?
No, the science on pandemics is actually pretty, it's basically as you figure out who's vulnerable, and then they quarantine, then they self-quarantine, and then everybody else just hangs out to get immunity. And that's like the best we got, is that's the way it was until this last pandemic.
Okay, so there wasn't like the additional layer of rebellion by like, I'm going to Woodstock, motherfucker, I don't care about your flu.
I don't know, there may have been. I mean, like, I don't know. It's just like, because it's kind of one of those, I think it's clearly an under-researched topic, right? Maybe after.
Well, even if it was researched, it went down the memory hole conveniently. Or the people that do remember are dead.
Right. Yeah. But like, it's, you know, but I would think that there could, you know, you could, I don't know. I'm pretty sure there's still plenty of evidence, you know, about like what was going on, what everybody thought. Like I said, there had just been a pandemic from China like 10 years before, right? You know, so it wasn't. And then a lot of those people, they probably like the people that survived the Spanish flu, like because they were only 40 years after the Spanish flu. And it's plenty, and like, that's what everybody's fear is, right? That any flu is going to be the Spanish flu, right? Because that one killed healthy people.
Well, I want to go back to a couple of different things. Jesus, I don't even know where to begin.
I know.
You guys, this interview, the reason I picked it, part of the reason, is because it's short and easy to listen to, but there really are so many different threads to pull on in it. It's very dense and mineable for discussion. But one thing, Bobby, you mentioned, like the United States itself becoming more of a national thing after World War II, as opposed to a regional structure, and that having to do with this kind of the ability for there to be a mass movement. And I was talking about the technological aspect, and I don't think that these are separate. I think that, and I don't think they're causally connected necessarily either. I just think that after World War II, you've got, as you said, people thinking of themselves as Americans rather than as Georgians or Ohioans or whatever. So you've got that. And then at the same time, you've also got this technology popping up, the automobile, that and being popularized, and then the television, both of which kind of by their nature make it easier to foster a kind of national consciousness. Everybody in America can watch the same thing on TV at the same time. You can easily drive from one state to the other on your own without any sort of mediator, right? Like the railroad companies or whatever. So I don't think that those technologies automatically lead to a national consciousness, but I do think that because there was already this post-World War II national consciousness arising, these new technologies made it just easier for that consciousness to basically take over. There was no alternative, really. Everybody was moving in this direction of nationhood following the war, you know, because America won. America was the great victor. And all of the kids being raised following that period of time, you know, they were putting their hand over their hearts and saying the Pledge of Allegiance to the American flag. And their parents, I'm sure, were reinforcing those beliefs. All of the good, like World War II movies and stuff that were coming out. And the Cold War also fostered a sense of national consciousness, because it's us versus them. So those elements, I think, bubble up on their own following World War II. But then if you combine that with the other technology that I mentioned, I think that creates a nexus that makes this kind of national Americanism easily pop up. And then right at the end of the 60s, you've got all of these young people, thanks to the accessibility of the automobile, and thanks to the fact that they've been raised on this national consciousness, they're able to create these gigantic meetings like Woodstock and stuff. And Woodstock was by no means the only one. I mean, there were festivals throughout the country. There were festivals in England, all of these like rock and roll hippie festivals. Woodstock wasn't even the biggest one. So I just wanted to point that out, in my opinion anyway. I think that the technology and the shifting post-World War II consciousness both play into that point that Jim made about who's going to be really important in the future are the connectors. That's the word he used, the connectors. And certainly nowadays, if we just like pull that idea of connectors to its conclusion 50 years later, it's like, well, connectors, that's the whole basis of our national and international communication now is pretty much social media. You know, it's these platforms that act as these connectors, right? So we don't need to gather in one spot. We just go on Twitter or whatever, and you can hear from Elon and he's going to tell you this or that, or you can go on Trump's Truth Social thing or whatever. You know, there are new forms of connectors now, but I think fundamentally the point Jim made is correct. Whether or not anyone likes it is another point, but the connectors, be they human beings or platforms, are maybe the most important thing in our modern world.
I mean, like, so I don't disagree with your premise that, like, technology played a part. It's very, like, I think they're definitely complementary. Like, I'm not confident in any story that we're telling. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense. It could be this, right? It could be, you know, that the technology created this. Because, you know, when you look at a lot of history, a lot of times, like, whenever, like, a new technology comes out, you get better swords than, like, this group of, you know, warriors tends to win more battles unless they become ascendant, right? You know, but also too, the Romans were really good at building roads, right? So they were able to get their army everywhere. I mean, I definitely think they're complementary. I think that very much the people, you know, the children that, you know, would go to these events. I mean, because we also saw this too with, say, like, you know, you had, you know, mass boycotts, you had riots that, like, wasn't just one city, right? But you had that in 1912, you know, where there was like a bunch of riots across, you know, like big ones in, you know, Massachusetts, and there was other ones, and they all happened right around the same time.
The example I would think of would be the labor movement, you know, all the communists running around in the early years of the 20th century.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely another one. You know, you had the Haymarket Affair, you know, you had a bunch of these going around. And I saw a really cool YouTube video, and was talking about how, like, the cops getting, like, the CB radio was how they were able to start to disperse all those things, because they were able to get, like, their army of cops on force to break up, you know, any type of protest really fast. It's like we're always in this constant battle of technology, like, and then who controls the technology. I think I disagree and then agree and then disagree and then agree with your point.
Well, yeah, and I mean, to be honest, that's kind of where I'm at with my own point. Like, I don't know. I don't have the answers. I'm just trying to, like, this is what I see. And I'm sure there are variables that I'm not seeing at all that make the 60s, whatever it was, you know, and how did it happen and all that stuff. I don't know. I just, what I see are these new technologies, specifically the automobile, but then also the changing conception of America. But I'm sure there's more to it than just that.
Do you see it, like, if you think about, like, the advent of the Cold War and how, like, all the intelligence agencies all came about during that time, you see it as, like, the first PSYOP and color revolution inside of the United States? I mean, is that something that you look at, or?
Well, it's not something that I've dismissed. As to the role of intelligence agencies in the countercultural movement itself, I know that there are some very interesting connections between, like, Grateful Dead and CIA. I know that there were connections between the Merry Pranksters group and CIA. Certainly, there were CIA and FBI agents working in the Haight-Ashbury district. Specifically, there was a free clinic in Haight-Ashbury that the Manson family actually frequented. And a number of other people frequented. It was a very notable clinic that pretty much everyone went to there. And it just so happened that, you know, later, upon declassifications of documents and stuff, turns out one of, like, the most prominent MK Ultra doctors was working out of that clinic. So these are pieces of information. I don't know that that means the entire counterculture movement was, like, an op, but that doesn't mean that elements of it weren't. You know, I think that probably there were elements of the counterculture that were influenced by U.S. intelligence.
Well, you know, you had the Weather Underground, and then, like, the thing I always think about is how, like, it's a very common trope in a lot of show, in a lot of, like, procedural, like, cop type shows, to where when they're dealing with, like, they'll like catch somebody from the Weather Underground or something, and then they go into how, like, there was, like, all these, like, cops in these groups, the ones that were always trying to start violence and all that type of jazz, right? You know, and that's, you know, we see that today, right? So I'm kind of at a point where I'm skeptical about how genuine the counterculture was beyond, like maybe it was just something that they set loose, and then, you know, it went in directions that they couldn't completely control.
Well, I mean, the government or CIA, whatever, intelligence agencies most certainly were responsible for the original distribution of LSD. You know, and so like whatever role that played in the counterculture, yes, maybe it just got out of control or whatever, but certainly they were a part of actually starting that, like distributing that particular drug, which of course became very important to the countercultural movement. Yeah, you know, it's just like we said with the technology and nationhood stuff. I don't know exactly what happened and what the government's role was, but I question my own story constantly. It's like, this is on the table. I don't have an answer one way or the other. I know that there was a role, but we don't know exactly what it was. But, you know, it's all open to question and interpretation, I think. But I do think that it's certainly the case that there was some government involvement in the counterculture. I think that's pretty much undeniable at this point. And so that kind of leads into another point that I wanted to mention, because it comes up in this interview. He says that sexual repression has been the grandest tool of the totalitarian. This is kind of a Freudian point, I guess. It's something that I've certainly heard a lot of people say in the past. But I'm not quite sure how accurate that is. At least, maybe it's accurate to an extent, but I don't think that it's sexual repression is like the basis of totalitarian control. I don't think that's true because, you know, I think sexual hedonism can very easily also be a tool of the totalitarian. And I mean, there are historical examples of this. It's not just like I'm pulling this out of my ass. Like, think of the Spartans. They were highly regimented, but their sexual practices were not Victorian in any sense of the imagination. They had wives, yes, but they also had like young boyfriends and stuff. There was sexual promiscuity. It was kind of lauded at times. So I want to get into that. And that kind of plays into also like the idea that perhaps the counterculture itself was an op of sorts, or at the very least, it was a sort of limited hangout, you know, a bunch of useful idiots, for lack of a better term, playing into the government's hands ultimately by thinking that by freeing ourselves sexually and using drugs and whatever, we're breaking away from the system, but actually just that hedonism leads you deeper into the grip of the system. By confusing sexual freedom for actual freedom, something like that.
Yeah. So I'm kind of with you on that. I think sexual freedom leads to centralization. I think you get more like Genghis Khan style harems as opposed to like, you know, people pairing off, which I think is more democratic and more freeing for humanity. I realize maybe we need to do a better job of helping people pick partners as a culture and a society, right? You hear a lot of like, there's a lot of terrible people that marry pretty nice people, and I mean, you just look at like the like I don't know, like pre internet censorship, when like OkCupid gave all that data on dating, and when you saw like the preferences between men and women, right? You know, like women fall, like when men did attractiveness and like on women, it would like follow the bell curve, right? Just like perfectly,
right.
Whereas like when women were looking at men, it's like 20% of them are just ugly. And so like completely undateable, and it's just very interesting, on that end, to where like the whole concept of the repression, it's almost very much, it's like without the, you know, the monogamous marriage system, you basically get like 40% of the male population who just don't get any partners, and then everything's like centralized, and then it's like, it's where you have a centralization of wealth, you have centralization. But there's also a centralization, you know, among women on that matter of who they prefer. Like I said, I don't really have a solution, like anything like that. So, but this is a point where I disagree. This is probably my like pro, you know, Christianity like bent.
I don't know about that, man. I was just listening to was it a Modern Wisdom recent? He's been having a lot of the evolutionary psychologists on, it seems like, lately.
Yeah.
And this one woman, some evolutionary psychologist, was talking about women, sex, and stances on abortion and things like that. And I don't really think it, if she's right, or, you know, these theories, you know, who knows? But it's like the more free sex there is, for instance, you know, where it's, you're not monogamous, you're not paired up, you're basically decreasing that market value, you know, for the women who do pair up. You know, it's like, oh, well, it costs a lot less, if that makes any sense. Like if my husband or whatever just wanted to go have sex, it's a lot easier now if there's, you know, a bunch of women who are just fine with having casual sex as opposed to a commitment, an investment in a relationship, a marriage, children, all that stuff, you know, like the value has gone down. So it's like women aren't able to be as choosy in their partners, if that makes sense. Cause it kind of seems like generally women sort of have more power in that sort of dynamic. Do you know what I mean?
So I'm not disagreeing with you on this. What I'm saying is that like the women, they're always fighting over the same guys. So unless you're one of the guys in like the upper echelon, then you're completely invisible to the market.
Wait, I got to think that through what you just said. It's always the same guys.
Yeah, it's always the same guys, right? You know,
do you mean like so it's always the same guys, like this top 20% most desirable men who probably are good looking, have good physical traits, have stable income or wealth? Do you mean like that?
Yes, yes. So like 20% of the men are sleeping with 80% of the women. So yeah, I mean, so they don't have the choices because they're only choosing, you know, because they're like, when it comes to just, you know, like the base desires, they're only like looking at like 20% of the population.
So you don't think that maybe ratio or percentage changed with birth control?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, it's definitely, that's another one of those technologies that hit in the 60s that we probably haven't, you know, discussed enough, right? But what I'm saying though is it's like in the sexual marketplace, women have the power when it comes to like in the current one and the who they sleep with. Men have the power in who they marry. And so that's where like by becoming more promiscuous, women have given up power in the marriage marketplace. That makes sense. So like, I agree with it, right? You know, like they can't choose their long-term partner in the same ways, right? Just look at the United States. Like, you know what the number one demographic for Biden right now is? It's unmarried women. It's the number one demographic for Democrats. Right. So in many ways, they're incentivized to like encourage.
What did you say? The number one demographic for what?
Democrats. For Democrats.
Oh, okay.
It's unmarried women. And it's going to be, and it's growing. It's like, I heard this. It's like a crazy stack in the United States. They're like, I don't know. It's like 50% of the women are going to expect to be unmarried by 2020 or not 2020, 2030 or 2035 in the United States. You know, so like they don't have a husband. So the government becomes their husband. And I know that's simplistic and reductive, but it works
for
this. No,
but I totally agree. You're right. This is what I'm saying. I think is the opposite of people, like you're saying, oh, free love, and it's going to mean liberation and freedom. But no, it doesn't.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree with you on that. So I'm saying like it hurts women in the fact because it hurts their ability to choose a long-term mate. So like it frees them up in the short term.
Exactly. That's why I was saying it water. You can describe it better, but like it waters down that marketplace. I can't command as much of a higher price to have sex with me, and that's not a prostitute. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It's hard for me to even enumerate what my take on this is, the whole sexual question. But one of the things that he says in the interview that really jumped out at me was that repression is the tool of the totalitarian. But I think that in itself is overly reductive and is perhaps conflating maybe totalitarianism with just culture, because, you know, sexual norms are things that exist pretty much universally. Even if you go to the most hedonistic, well, let's not say the most hedonistic, but if you look at certain tribes, indigenous tribes throughout the world, maybe they don't have the same sexual norms that, you know, Anglo-Saxon England or whatever does, but they still have sexual norms. There's still some sort of practice that they perform. Cultures around the world obviously have some kind of sexual system in place. It's not always the same system, but it is a system. And so you could argue that, oh, well, all of these systems are based on repression because people can't just do whatever they want. But that, first of all, that doesn't necessarily mean that repression is unnatural. If all humans are doing it, that perhaps suggests that the social creation of sexual norms is maybe something humans naturally do. So maybe it's not such a bad thing. But also, there's a connection that is being made here, between totalitarianism and repression, that I think Jim is skipping a step here. Perhaps it's that sexual repression, or I would say the establishment of sexual norms, is maybe a basis of culture. But to say, to immediately take that to totalitarianism, I think is throwing the cultural or civilizational baby out with the bathwater.
It's retarded. 100% retarded. There are anthropological reasons why humans regulate sex.
Mm-hmm.
It's why we have kept going. Like, we wouldn't exist if people just freely fucked, because there'd be like 5 men in the world and eventually they would die.
Right. Well, and that's just not a natural way to behave.
Which, by the way, is exactly what is happening currently to our population, where 30 guys fuck everything out there and most of the other men don't get laid.
Well, nowadays people talk about the incel problem. It's like, well, can you really divorce that from this kind of attitude, you know, this sexual revolution attitude? And so many of the sexual revolutionary types always want to say, like, you know, human beings are, maybe they don't say this explicitly, but they imply that human beings in their natural state are just sexually promiscuous, banging whoever they want, whenever they want. And I don't buy that. And the reason I don't buy it is because every human society has not done that. Like, they all establish norms at some point or another.
Well, but the established norms, because if you did do exactly what he's saying, you had an unregulated sexual market, your population would die. That's the point I'm making. Like, it's anthropological. This is like an evolutionary thing. The tribes that regulate sex will continue because they can. Eventually, you kill off your tribe if you are unregulated. I mean, if for no other reason than we'll say, like, it would thin out the gene pool if only 5 guys fucked every woman.
Yeah.
Like, there's a whole host of, like, scientific reasons why it would happen.
Well, and to an extent, we see this when royals would interbreed, because they, in a way, they were actually kind of practicing in a kind of paradoxically a regulated form of this promiscuity, you know. And so they would, within their own circle, they would break the taboos that were applied to the normal population. Common people weren't supposed to partake of incest, you know, like that's in the Bible. That's not what you're supposed to do. But yet royals, for whatever reason, are allowed to do it. By breaking the taboo, you see where it leads. It leads to the Habsburg chin, babbling morons leading nations. So if you apply that same logic just to anybody, like, yeah, go ahead, fuck your sister, who cares? It's not going to work out very well. Same thing happened to Darwin and all those people who were trying to interbreed back in the Victorian times. You know, they thought they were going to breed a master race, but it didn't work out.
Well, it's okay. So I kind of want to go back to something you were talking about, how like the idea of, you know, just being like with free love, how it like the repression prevents freedom. So one of my big guys that I'm a big fan of is Jocko, and his Jocko Willink, and his big thing is discipline equals freedom. So if you're disciplined financially, then you get financial freedom. If you're disciplined with your diet, then you get like, and your exercise, then you like get like health freedom. And it's the same with this. Is like, these are like social constructs, you know, that discipline, you know, controlling sex on an aspect, but that leads to freedom. It's one of these, you know, these paradoxes of life that I think like when you game theory things out more than just like one step in front of you, a lot of these like truths become apparent. That's why a lot of the religions, or a lot of everybody, you know, you look at like Stoicism, you look at like yogis, you look at a lot of different things, they all come back to the same point that, you know, you need to, you know, resist temptation, because it comes in waves, and those who can resist it, that can look further, they're the ones that survive.
And so conversely, on the other hand, going off of that, if you look at the other side of the coin, you've got this counterculture in the 60s that is saying, hey, you know, forget all that bullshit, forget discipline. Follow your desires wherever they lead you. If you want to fuck, well, go out and fuck. If you want to do some drugs and whatever, like, go out and do it. It's fine. Do whatever you want, man. And their idea was that that would lead to actual freedom. My opinion, and it's not like I'm coming up with this, it's kind of the Huxley thing in Brave New World, My opinion is the exact opposite, that this immediate pursuit of pleasure seeking and instant gratification, that's probably going to lead more towards totalitarianism than a disciplined society will. You know, obviously there are problems with discipline, like as far as a government regimenting its people, sure. But what's a better way of controlling the masses than just letting them bang each other all the time whenever they want? Like, okay.
What is their goal now? To stick people in front of video games and pornography. That is the whole goal. Feed them full of fucking chemicals, whatever's cheap to give them, and let them watch porn and video games to keep them occupied until they kill themselves off.
And ironically, sexual liberation has opened the door, again to make a pun, has opened the door to depopulation, which sounds crazy, except that when sexual freedom is something that's now expected, basically these days, you know, promiscuity is viewed as a right. And in a culture that sees sex in that way, you're going to have like widespread birth control because everyone's banging all the time and they don't want to have kids because they want to keep banging. You know, it's going to be harder to go around banging everybody if you got a kid to take care of. So this leads to non-reproductive ways of having sex.
So I want you to also consider, I mean, how much do you know about the 60s counterculture? What's the purpose? What is the same purpose it still has today? To destroy the society.
To rebel against the status quo, right?
Exactly. It wants society as it exists to end. So even back then, they knew what the hell they were doing. Obviously, I always talk about like the whole punk rock thing and like lament, I guess, how all the things that used to make punk rock interesting and outside the norms have been adopted by the main culture. Well, the problem with that is that like I think Thaddeus has actually talked about it. It's like the shamanism. You know, the people on the outsides, they're the ones that kind of slowly push society in directions by feeling out the boundaries and seeing if there's not better places for those boundaries that are more free. The problem is when your entire fucking society does that, it completely destabilizes the entire thing. You no longer have your shamans doing it. You have your fucking main population doing it, and it can't stand anymore.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, in the what's a better example of that than the 60s, where now every like bland ass radio station is playing rebellious 60s music, and it's grandpa music now. It's not on the outside anymore. It's become the mainstream, and it's become the mainstream in all of the worst ways. You know, earlier we mentioned very briefly the hypocrisy of the boomer who went to Woodstock during pandemic. And, you know, sure, they weren't pushing the quarantining or whatever back then, but it's just ironic aesthetically that, you know, back then they're all free love and let's go and whatever, go party. And then as they get older, I think their attitude of liberation actually reveals itself in the way they acted during COVID. And to speak generally, the way boomers are often caricatured, it turns out that that sense of freedom and rebellion wasn't actually a very lofty ideal. It turns out it was actually just kind of self-serving.
There's people that were willing to throw their grandkids under the bus.
Right. So if you look at this kind of, and I know I'm overgeneralizing here, but that's fine. Generalization is perfectly okay, so long as you acknowledge what it is. But, you know, the hippie is kind of caricatured or portrayed as this selfless individual who just cares about peace and love and moving everything in the right direction. But I don't buy it. I think that maybe there are some like that or were, but really it was just a veil for self-aggrandizement and getting what you want when you want it. I think fundamentally the selfless hippie is actually incredibly selfish. So there, I can't prove that, but you know, I have my reasons for thinking that.
I think that goes without saying even.
Yeah. Well, maybe it does now, but I figure while we're on the subject of, you know, this Jim Morrison interview, I'll throw it in the record here. So all of that being said though, with the sexual repression and whatnot, I still really enjoy this interview. I disagree with that point that he makes. I think it's a commonly made point, but I think it's wrong. I think that sexual repression, even repression is maybe not a very good word for what we're describing, but
regulation.
Yeah. Regulation, sexual
regulate norm. Yourself or someone else can regulate you, but regulation is going to happen. I mean, so what happens if you, I guess, why do we regulate ourselves? Because we can look what happens in animal populations. If you don't regulate yourself, eventually you eat all of your food and you die.
Right.
If you've never seen like animal population collapse, then like, you know, I guess maybe you don't understand that, but.
Yeah, I don't feel repressed that I get, it's expected that I put clothes on when I leave the house. Yeah. I wonder some other thing that he said that I was like, wait a minute, what? And I was, you know, he obviously can't expound upon it now. But he seemed like he kind of had some contradicting thoughts where he was talking about, like towards the end, I think, of the interview, they were talking about masculine versus feminine. And that interview even mentioned unisex. I was like, ooh,
right.
Must have been a new term for then. I was like, huh. Yeah. But in one statement, you know, he said something like, you know, people are passive, basically, like he doesn't understand why more people aren't getting involved. And I don't know what he means by that. If that means going to a protest, or that means voting, or maybe it means none of that, but just kind of like the general apathy, which yeah. I can appreciate that, you know. And then at the same time, then he was saying that, like, he was like, women at the end, he was like, women are better, basically, than men. You know, like they could, men could learn something from women, how they just, they're, I don't know, it wasn't like they're go with the flow, but like, I don't know, they're not getting like uptight and worried about this or that. I don't remember now. And I was like, wait a minute, what the fuck are you trying to say here? Like, should you go with the flow and just kind of relax? Or should you be like, I can't relax. Like, there's injustices in the world.
Am I to say that this is the nail in the coffin to the theory that Jim Morrison was absolutely a part of the government meant to pipe Piper the generation in the wrong direction?
Well, I don't know if it's a nail in the coffin, but it certainly might point in that direction. Yeah, basically, he says everything that Gretchen just said, but then also the interviewer asks him, like, well, so are you saying that part of the reason men are becoming less masculine is because we live in a society with all the luxury and all of the basic necessities of survival are taken care of? There isn't a need for men to be as masculine as they used to be. And Jim says, yeah, that might be it. And then the interviewer asks him, do you think this is a good thing? And Jim says, yeah. So, you know, interpret that however you will. I disagree. Now, I don't know where, it's not that I disagree because I wish that we lived in a world where we didn't have the luxuries we do. The reason I think that the decay of masculinity because of luxury is a problem is simply on a practical basis, I don't share the 1960s utopian belief that progress is indefinite. And they don't mention this in the interview, but my problem with it is this great luxurious society you're talking about that makes it so men don't have to be men. What in God's name makes you think this is going to last forever? It falls apart. You know what I mean? And so then when it does fall, who's going to fix it if there are no men left?
Can we blame the Christians for this part of it?
Maybe. Why?
The people that want to separate us from animals and think that we don't have to follow the same rules that animals follow.
Yeah.
The idea that we can live without war precludes, oh wait, every other fucking creature out there kills each other. Why would we be the one thing that doesn't do that?
Right.
I mean, as long as space is a finite thing, human beings are always going to get in scruffles around the edges. How big those things are is whatever. Honestly, I think those things will tend to be bigger when you have nuclear weapons to point at each other because you have emasculated your society and need to manufacture your dicks as opposed to having big men fighting in your behalf on the edges.
Yeah, yeah. There's no more Achilles or Odysseus, and so we're just left with these, you know, nukes.
Yeah, well, you don't have to get down and dirty in person, right? You can just fucking shoot a missile. There's no hand-to-hand combat.
And once again, if you regulate yourself, you don't have to have the society regulate you. The same things always happen. It's just, is a government going to do it, or are you going to do it? Because they're anthropologically necessary to keep human survival.
Yeah. So those were really the two pieces of this interview that bugged me, the sexual thing and the masculinity thing, because both of it's like, regardless of what I even want to be true or what my opinion is regarding these things. Like, you know, my opinion, my reading of humankind is that actually sexual repression is not the tool of totalitarians. That's kind of ridiculous. But, and the masculinity thing, sure, I would prefer it if people actually were masculine and others were feminine. You know, like, I actually like both masculinity and femininity, and I don't think one of them should be destroyed effectively. But regardless of what I like and what my opinions are, I just think it's crazy to assume that we can do away with these fundamental pieces of what it is to be humans in a society. Oh, we're just going to do away with sexual regulation and masculinity. What? You can't do away with that any more than we can just choose to do away with a human emotion or the necessity to breathe. Like, these are part of what we are. The hubris of the progressive individual is just mind-boggling to me. We're going to get to a point technologically where we no longer need to be human. It's fundamentally transhuman, and it gives me the willies.
That's what I was going to say. It's like, everything you say is making me think of, like, I mean, this is just the Kurzweil project at the beginning, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Beginning is, what was MKUltra ever really?
Oh, God. Well, that's a big... What do you think it was?
I think it was the beginning of this project.
The, like, transhuman molding people into little pawns?
The minute we made computers, it was the minute people wanted to be computers.
Yeah, and there's an article that everyone can read, and I've got to get going, so I'll throw this out there in closing. But if anyone wants to see what Nikki just said, there's an article called Man-Computer Symbiosis. Man-Computer Symbiosis. All right? You can't really get more on the head than that. And it was written by a guy named J.C.R. Licklider back in 1960. And this is the guy who actually came up with the idea for the internet before the ARPANET. And his whole thing was like, look, human beings and machines are going to have to create a system in which they evolve together. You could read the article. It's like 2 pages long, maybe. I highly recommend it because what you just said is dead on. This guy did influence the creation of the internet. He was a major figure in the history of computing. And he said right from the beginning, like, this is a evolutionary track that we're embarking on. And you're not going to be able to separate the evolution of technology from the evolution of man.
And who spent his entire life working on game theory for that?
Who?
Asimov.
Mm.
His, you know, the robot series. Everything he ever fucking wrote was about how do human beings interact with a world where computers can exist? Because eventually computers are going to become the perfect humans. And then where do we fit into that world?
Right. Yeah. We're like lesser hominids. You know, we're the Neanderthals and they're the Homo sapiens or whatever, Homo erectus, in that analogy.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very disturbing to think of where this leads. And ironically, the hippie with his kind of back to nature philosophy, you know, in one of those paradoxical ways. Despite that, the hippie was also very ready to embrace technology. Certainly, we see the two sides of the hippie coin being the communal farming and stuff, but also things like the Whole Earth Catalog, which was selling computers and whatnot. There was this coupling of naturalism and computer technology. And again, another thing, the documentary The Net, I would recommend everyone would watch. As well as the series All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace, I believe it's called, that really points this stuff out, that there's a philosophy of technology that basically uses technology as a proxy for nature and says that the computer is something that mimics the kind of holistic natural world that we live in, and that nature and computing really need to be tied into one network.
Well, how about this? How about Douglas Adams? How does the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy end? Because Earth was always a computer, is how that ends. It was a computer put together to analyze a specific problem that these aliens had come up with. The ultimate question. It was supposed to be calculating the answer to the ultimate question. And Earth was accidentally destroyed, like, and paved over for a interstellar, like, throughway. and ultimately, like, these superior beings that had Earth created were mice, which is fucking hilarious. And it was literally created because they created the most advanced supercomputer in the world. And they asked, what's the answer to the ultimate question? And they said 17.
I thought it was 42.
Oh, it was a 42? Whatever. Some fucking number point. Some random number. And then they have to have, then they ask him, well, what's the ultimate question? He's like, I don't know the ultimate question. That's the answer to it. But if you want a question, we're going to have to make another computer. Right. And the end joke of the movie is that Earth was the computer and they destroyed it. So they had to recreate Earth to finish the computation. Douglas Adams was a really fucking smart guy. Let's put it that way. Like, it's very, very funny and silly in a lot of ways. That, like, if you don't think about, like, what's really behind what he said, like, oh shit, oh, that's, yeah, because that's part of it. Like, before Earth was destroyed, all of the dolphins left Earth because, you know, they're the second most advanced species on Earth,
right?
Human beings are only third. little jokes like that.
Nice. Anyway, thank you for joining me and talking about this thing.
Yeah, that was fun. Thanks for suggesting something.
Hey.
Hey, I'm not talking about no revolution. I'm not talking about no demonstration. I'm not talking about getting out in the streets. I'm talking about having some fun. I'm talking about dancing. I'm talking about love your neighbor till it hurts. I'm talking about grab your friend. I'm talking about love. I'm talking about some love. I'm talking about some love. I'm talking about love. Love, 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 love. Grab your fucking friend and love it. Come on!
Tell me where your freedom lies. The streets are fields that never die. Deliver.